A speech to the United States Congress, delivered in the Capitol, Washington, May the 19th, 1943.
Mr. President, Mr. Speaker, and members of the Senate and the House of Representatives, 17 months have passed since I last had the honor to address the Congress of the United States. For more than 500 days, every day a day, we have toiled and suffered and dared, shoulder to shoulder, against the cruel and mighty enemy. We have acted in close combination or concert in many parts of the world, on land, on sea, and in the air. The fact that you have invited me to come to Congress again, a second time, now that we have settled down to the job, and that you should welcome me in so generous a fashion, is certainly a high mark in my life, and it also shows that our partnership has not done so badly. I'm proud that you should have found us good allies, striving forward in comradeship to the accomplishment of our task, without grudging or stinting either life or treasure, or indeed anything we have to give. Last time, I came at a moment when the United States was aflame with wrath at the treacherous attack upon Pearl Harbor by Japan, and at the subsequent declarations of war upon the United States made by Germany and Italy. For my part, I say quite frankly that in those days, after our long and for a whole year lonely struggle, I could not repress in my heart a sense of relief and comfort that we were all bound together by common peril, by solemn faith, and high purpose to see this fearful quarrel through at all costs to the end. That was an hour of passionate emotion, an hour most memorable in human record, an hour that I believe full of hope and glory for the future. The experiences of a long life and the promptings of my blood have wrought in me the conviction that there is nothing more important for the future of the world than the fraternal association of our two peoples in righteous work, both in war and peace.
Winston Churchill's speech continued.
In our conferences in January 1942, between the President and myself, and between our high expert advisors, it was evident that while the defeat of Japan would not mean the defeat of Germany, the defeat of Germany would infallibly mean the ruin of Japan. The realization of this simple truth does not mean that both sides should not proceed together. And indeed, the major part of the United States forces is now deployed on the Pacific Front. In the broad division which we then made of our labors in January 1942, the United States undertook the main responsibility for prosecuting the war against Japan and for aiding Australia and New Zealand to defend themselves against a Japanese invasion, which then seemed far more threatening than it does now. On the other hand, we took the main burden on the Atlantic. This was only natural. Unless the ocean lifeline which joins our two peoples can be kept unbroken, the British Isles and all the very considerable forces which radiate therefrom would be paralyzed and doomed. Opinion, Mr. President, is divided as to whether the use of air power could by itself bring about the collapse in Germany or Italy. The experiment is well worth trying, so long as other measures are not excluded. Well, there's certainly no harm in finding out. But however that may be, anyhow, we are all agreed that the damage done to the enemy's war potential is enormous. The condition to which the great centers of German war industry, and that particularly the Ruhr, are being reduced is one of unparalleled devastation. You have just read of the destruction of the great dams which feed the canals and provide power to the enemy munition works. That was a gallant operation, costing 8 out of the 19 Lancaster bombers employed. But it will play a very far-reaching part in German munitions output. I was driving the other day, not far from the field of Gettysburg, which I know well, like most of your battlefields. It was the decisive battle of the Civil War. No one after Gettysburg doubted which way the dread balance of war would incline. Yet far more blood was shed after the Union victory at Gettysburg than in all the fighting which went before. It beholds us, therefore, to search our hearts and brace our sinews and take the most earnest counsel one with another in order that the favorable position which has already been reached both against Japan and against Hitler and Mussolini in Europe shall not be let slip. If we wish to abridge the slaughter and ruin which this war is spreading to so many lands, and to which we must ourselves contribute so grievous a measure of suffering and sacrifice, we cannot afford to relax a single fiber of our being or to tolerate the slightest abatement of our effort. The enemy is still proud and powerful. He is hard to get at. He still possesses enormous armies, vast resources, and invaluable strategic territory. War is full of mysteries and surprises. A false step, a wrong direction of strategic effort, discord or lassitude among the Allies might soon give the common enemy the power to confront us with new and hideous threats. We have surmounted many serious dangers. But there is one grave danger which will go along with us till the end. That danger is the undue prolongation of the war. No one can tell what new complications and perils might arise in 4 or 5 more years of war. And it is in the dragging out of war, at enormous expense, till the democracies are tired or bored or split, that the main hopes of Germany and Japan must now reside. We must destroy this hope as we have destroyed so many others. And for that purpose, we must beware of every topic, however attractive, and every tendency, however natural, which turns our minds or energies from the supreme objective of the general victory of the United Nations. By singleness of purpose, by steadfastness of conduct, by tenacity and endurance, such as we have so far displayed, by these, and only by these, can we discharge our duty to the future of the world and to the destiny of man?